Excellent. So thank you, everyone, for signing in this evening. We're very fortunate. This is Sarah. We're very fortunate to have two of our collaborators speaking with us this evening from the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. You know, we're particularly excited about this with Suicide Awareness Month coming up, and they're going to tell you about some really exciting work and white paper that they have coming out. So we're very grateful for their time this evening and hoping to use that as an opportunity to kickstart with our group a discussion about our groups and our task force's plans for what we can do within our own communities for Suicide Awareness Month. So we have two speakers from the Brady Center this evening, Rebecca Adeskovitz, who is a senior program manager, and she has really been doing a lot of the day-to-day management for the public awareness and education programs. So any questions around that, and I know we've talked a lot as a task force about how we do public awareness. Rebecca has lots of experience in that. The other thing I loved seeing in your bio, Rebecca, is that you were formerly a high school social studies teacher, so that means you have infinite patience and good educational skills. So Jenny Lintz, who's the director of public health and safety at the Brady Center, is also going to be with us this evening on the call. And she oversees the public health and safety campaigns, the Ask Saves Kids, the Speak Up, and the Suicide Proof Your Home campaign. And it sounds like a lot of the national implementation work that the Brady Center has done so amazingly has been under her leadership. So thank you both so much for taking your time this evening. We're really grateful to hear about the work you've been doing and to hopefully prompt some of our task force members' ability to work in their own community. So Rebecca and Jenny, thanks so much, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, and thank you for everyone on the phone for joining us today. Rebecca and I are going to take you – this is Jenny. Rebecca and I are going to take you through a short presentation and then leave time for questions. But first I wanted to take a small step back and acknowledge that, you know, for many people, when we think about gun violence, we think about mass shootings, gang-related incidents, domestic violence. And when we talk about how to prevent gun violence, we overwhelmingly talk about preventing homicide. That's what we really mean. And often that really is about policy, laws. But that's not how most people die by guns in this country. Of course, there are 20, you guys probably know very well, there are 20,000 gun suicides in the United States every year, which is two-thirds of most gun deaths. So these tragedies rarely make the news or prompt action for lawmakers, but they add up to clearly a tragedy of staggering proportions. And as Brady, as a gun violence prevention group whose goal is to reduce gun death and injury, we can't continue to allow those deaths to not be part of the conversation, particularly because the research is so compelling and clear, the connection between firearms and suicide, it's just that many people don't know about it. So as Sarah mentioned, we're coming up on Suicide Prevention Month, and actually the week beginning on the 7th is Suicide Prevention Week, and we'll be sharing lots of information with our supporters and collaborators about the link between guns and suicide, with the goal to increase the understanding of the strong link between firearms and suicide, heightening awareness about the risk of suicide associated with having a firearm in the home, and that suicide can be prevented by limiting access to lethal suicide means, particularly firearms, but including things like medication. Ultimately, Brady's goal for all our public health education campaigns is to help families understand not just the perceived benefits, but the risks of having a gun in the home, and try to balance a narrative that, of course, has existed for a very long time, that guns provide protection. So the report that we're going to summarize today will be released next week, and I know that the link will be sent around. But we wanted to walk you through some of the highlights of the report and end with kind of what, we hope hopefully is a little inspiration and ways that you could participate in Suicide Prevention Month. So first, taking a look at the trends. The number of suicides by firearm has pretty much always exceeded the number of firearm homicides, definitely for the past 30 years. and all types of gun deaths have declined from their peak, but gun homicides declined much more steeply. And recently, the gap between, even though they both sort of leveled, the gap between firearm homicide and firearm suicide has widened. So in 2006, 55% of firearm-related deaths were suicide, and in 2013, which is the most recent year we have available, suicides are now accounting for about two-thirds of all gun deaths, which is the highest share since at least 1981, you know, as far back as CDC recorded the information in this way. So I'm going to kind of turn it over to Rebecca to take you through some of the charts, and then we'll come back and answer any questions.
And I'll just take this opportunity quick to remind people that if you have background noise, you can press *6 to mute your lines and then press *6 again later if you have a question.
Thank you. So to continue on the path that Jenny had started, so what we did in our report was we really synthesize a lot of the data that's currently available and research on this firearm suicide connection. There's an overwhelming amount of data and research which points to this relationship. And so what we did was we tried to compile the information and make it readable and understandable so that we can really get this message out there. So one of the things that we did was look at the scientific evidence on the suicide-firearm connection. And we know that most of it shows either that the presence of a gun in the home increases the risk of suicide, or there's also an abundance of studies that also show that suicide rates are higher where firearms are prevalent. So those are the two kind of sources of research that are supporting this relationship. So there have been about over a dozen U.S. case control studies that have looked at the presence of guns in the home and the risk of suicide. And what they found is that all of them have shown that a gun in the home increases the risk of suicide. Which is pretty amazing when you consider that these studies took into account different populations and used different methodology, but they all came up with the same result. A recent meta-analysis combined the results from 14 national and international studies and found that access to firearms increases the risk of suicide more than 3 times. So supporting this individual level data is also the research that has taken place at the national, state, and regional levels. And so these ecological studies have looked at firearm ownership and suicide rates. And even though there are a number of issues with analyzing the data at this level, most notably the lack of reliable data on firearm ownership and the serious underreporting of suicides, the research has still found that a strong relationship exists between firearms and suicide. Namely that where there are more guns, there are more suicides. There was one study in particular that was done by David Hemingway and Matthew Miller, both researchers at Harvard. And the study compared state-level firearm ownership with suicide rates. And they separated the data, and they looked at the 15 states with the highest levels of firearm ownership and compared that with 6 states with the lowest levels of firearm ownership, even though there was a between the two groups, there was an even population. So they were looking at an even population across the two groups. What they found was that in the group with states with the highest levels of firearm ownership had nearly twice as many suicides as the group of 6 states with the lowest levels of firearm ownership. And so if we look at a map, we can see clear evidence of this relationship just by
filling in levels of household firearm ownership, which we've done here in this map. The darkest areas are the areas with the highest levels of household firearm ownership. And so if we compare that to firearm suicide rates, we see that the states with the highest rates, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, Idaho, and Oklahoma, also have very high rates of household firearm ownership. In fact, these states all have 12 to 20 percentage points higher than the national average, which is 32.6%. And then we also see that the reverse is true with states with the lowest rates of firearm suicide. They all have gun ownership rates well below the national average. So we see that there's this strong relationship, and so obviously the next question is why. What are the factors driving this? And we found, or the research has shown, that there are three main factors that are contributing to this connection. First, the wide availability of firearms. Second, the high lethality of firearms as a suicide method. And then finally, the fact that many suicides are impulsive. So first, if we look at the availability of firearms, we see that firearm ownership is more prevalent in the United States than in any other country. We know that there are somewhere between 270 and 310 million, although we don't have one definitive source of firearm ownership in the U.S. We do have a number of social science surveys and a number of research studies have looked at this issue. And so we've are pretty confident that about a third of U.S. households in the U.S. have a firearm. But across the country and between among gun owners, storage practices vary widely. And so we also know that about 1.7 million children live with unlocked and loaded firearms. So here we also show that firearms are highly lethal as a suicide method. Between 85 and 91% of firearm suicide attempts are fatal, compared with 3% or less for some of the other most commonly used methods, such as overdosing or wrist cutting. So in this graph here, we have a comparison of fatal suicide attempts and non-fatal suicide attempts. And so if you look at the fatal suicide attempts, you'll see that a little more than half involve a firearm. But you look at non-fatal suicide attempts, you see that only a very small percentage involve a firearm. By and large, overdose is the leading cause of non-fatal suicide attempts. So even though firearms are used in only a small fraction of suicide attempts, they account for over half of all suicide deaths. And then finally, we also know that although some suicides are carefully planned, many others are not. There's an impulsive element to many suicides. If you look at the graph here, we see that in a study of suicide attempt survivors, the amount of time that elapsed between the decision and the actual suicide attempt was surprisingly short. So we see that 24% contemplated for less than 5 minutes, 48% deliberated for less than 20 minutes, and 71% within an hour made their decision and attempted suicide. So there's a surprisingly short window between the time when someone makes the decision and they actually attempt suicide. And with firearms, that's a very important window of opportunity for prevention. So given the connection between firearms and suicide, it would seem logical that making firearms less available would be an effective strategy for prevention. And this has been proven to be effective. Since many suicides are impulsive, separating someone from the means to self-harm takes away their ability to act quickly. And so when we're talking about limiting access to lethal means, we're talking about firearms, but we're also talking about other methods of suicide as well. So as we see in this diagram, means reduction can lead to one of two things. So it can either delay the suicide attempt, since many suicidal crises are often short-lived. This means that for many, the impulse will pass without being realized. But there's also the opportunity for substitution. If another suicide method is attempted, or I'm sorry, if another suicide method is substituted, there's still a good chance that it's going to be less lethal than a firearm, and that will still increase the chances of survival. But most research has shown that the risk of method substitution is pretty low. And so either way, whether the suicide attempt is delayed or whether another less lethal method is substituted, the long-term chances of survival are very good. We know that studies have shown that 90% of people who attempt suicide and survive do not go on to die by suicide. So once they're able to get past the suicidal impulse, the chances of survival are very good. And then what research has also shown is that not only can means reduction have an impact on the method-specific suicide rate, so in the case of firearms, limiting access to firearms can lower the firearm suicide rate, but also the overall suicide rate as well. And the two factors that really influence whether the overall suicide rate will decline is whether the method is highly lethal and whether it makes up a large proportion of the of suicide attempts and deaths. And so even though means reduction has been proven to be effective and was actually found by an international panel of experts to be only one of two proven methods of suicide prevention, it hasn't been widely implemented. And there are a number of reasons for that. But fortunately, research has shown that there are a number of really terrific opportunities for prevention that are out there, which, you know, provide real, like I said, opportunity for programs to implement means reduction strategies. So the first opportunity is around youth. We know that 82% of adolescent suicides involve a gun belonging to a family member. So it's important that parents of adolescents and young adults be educated on the risks of guns in the home, and that parents are encouraged to store their guns safely or to remove them altogether. We know that keeping guns locked and unloaded does have a protective effect and can reduce the odds of death by up to 73%. But we also know that removing a gun from the home is the most reliable and most effective way to prevent suicide. Another opportunity that has been identified in the research is that over 70% of older Americans who die by suicide use a firearm. A lot of times, suicide among the elderly is an overlooked problem, and it's just not given the attention that suicide among younger age groups are given. But many older people struggle with chronic health conditions, and their decreased health and physical condition leads to or can trigger suicidal behavior. But we know that older Americans are also one of the groups with the highest levels of firearm ownership. And so that can really increase the risk of suicide death. And then another important consideration for the elderly is the fact that many of them, due to the effects of medication or because of the onset of dementia, lack judgment or awareness of the risks of firearms, so that becomes an even more serious problem. So making sure that caregivers, whether it's family members or professional caregivers, are made aware of the risks of guns in the home is also an important avenue for prevention. And then finally, we also know through research that about 77% of people who die by suicide have had contact with a primary care provider in the year before their death, which is extremely important. And I know that I'm sure this is something that many of you are already familiar with. Many providers recognize their role in suicide prevention. Unfortunately, others do not. And so research has shown that there's still a lack of understanding about just the fundamentals of whether suicide actually can be prevented or how it can be prevented or what role healthcare providers can play, and so that's really important to get that information out to everyone and make sure that all providers are aware of the important role that they can play in preventing suicide. And that was actually, just to note, one of the recommendations from the 2012 National Strategy for Suicide Prevention. And so, as Jenny mentioned earlier, Suicide Prevention Week begins next week, and so we're going to be, in addition to releasing this report, we're going to be raising awareness about the connection between firearms and suicide. And we're going to be doing that in a lot of different ways, through the media, particularly social media. And so here on this slide we have some examples of the graphics, social media graphics that we're going to be posting throughout the week and that we're going to be making available to our partners and to individuals and encouraging them to share as well to help us to bring attention to this important issue. And so that pretty much wraps it up for us. I know, I'm hoping that you have some questions for us that we can answer, that we can lead to a short discussion.
Well, thank you, Jenny and Rebecca. That was a very interesting and thorough presentation. Callers can press *6 to unmute your lines if you have questions, and I'll let you take over there with moderating, Sarah.
Don't forget to unmute your line if you have any questions for our speakers.
So this is Jerry, Jerry Walden. One of my questions, since you know, there's so many veterans who are committing suicide. Do we know if any of the higher up, generals have asked the veterans to leave their guns somewhere else if they're having emotional problems? Has there been any campaign like that that you know of?
I'll jump in a little bit. Go ahead, Rebecca.
No, you go first.
Okay. So there's been a lot of, controversy around whether veterans indeed have an elevated risk for suicide. Veterans happen to fall into the category of more likely to because they're older, rural, white men. So there's a question and a little bit of discussion on what element is resulting in this increased risk. Is it because they fall into this higher risk category? And there's been some really interesting research about kind of the role of deployment, because I think that's a common kind of go-to for people that, they've had this experience, and so they're in having some PTSD-type behavior that's leading to suicidal behavior, but really it's been shown that they're sort of not related to deployment. So there's some interesting stuff. The VA does and has done a lot of work with the Harvard School of Public Health on educating, VA through the healthcare network to talk to family members about the risk of the guns in the home. And there's definitely lots of discussion around background checks and kind of the role of making sure that the information that's gathered in those medical visits, if it rises to a certain level, is reported to NICS. There is nothing that I'm aware of, I don't know if you are, Rebecca, about kind of encouraging people to store their guns outside of the home or when they've completed their commitment to store their gun, not bring the gun home. I'm not aware of anything like that, although there's certainly a precedent for that in other countries. I don't know if Rebecca, you want to talk a bit about the Israel example there.
Sure. I do remember seeing something about, and I think it was I'm not exactly sure which branch of the military, I think it was the Navy, that was beginning to explore some sort of means reduction strategy. But I would have to double check, but I can look into that and send any information that I find to Becky to share with the group. But the study that Jenny is referring to is a study that was done in Israel with the Israeli Defense Forces, and they instituted a policy which required members to store their firearms on base during weekend leave. What they found was that the policy resulted in a 40% reduction in overall suicide rates. And they found that it was almost entirely due to the policy, because weekday suicide rates remained the same. It was only suicides taking place over the weekend that dropped due to the policy.
I know that, I guess, New Hampshire has been doing some work on this, but with gun storage, for instance, at gun dealers as a temporary measure when people are depressed, et cetera. Are other states also finding places to store guns temporarily for these people?
Well, actually, the New Hampshire project is really a collaboration with gun shops and gun dealers to prevent the sale of firearms to anyone who might appear to be in crisis or appear to be suicidal, and then also working with them to educate customers on what they can do to prevent suicide at home, you know, making sure that they're aware of the risks of suicide from having a gun in the home and what they can do to mitigate those risks. So it doesn't involve the program, as far as I know, doesn't involve actual storage, but that is a serious issue and problem, something that we've come across ourselves.
Yeah, so focus on kind of the temporary removal is something that everyone thinks is probably a good way to talk about it. So right now, at this point in your life, it might, the kind of cost-benefit analysis might look different for you, right? You have a child who's entering adolescence. You have an older parent in the home. But kind of what, so saying that to someone without kind of the practical and so what am I supposed to do, is kind of a real challenge on our issue, finding whether it be police or gun stores who are willing to store or even take the gun is a real challenge. And I think it's a gap that, you know, we're working on. And I hope if anyone's aware of kind of that getting filled effectively in the community is something that could be shared. We really want to be able to promote that idea. We think it's probably the most effective way to talk about it as temporary removal. But the problem is that if you're kind of relying on friends to store it for you, they might have children, they might have people who visit their home, they might be at risk. It does sort of raise some concerns about kind of putting in the problem on someone else. And of course, in certain states where there's strict rules around background checks and firearm transfers, it might actually not even be totally legal, although we're sure very unlikely that would be something that anyone would prosecute. But certainly friends and family transfers of firearms is something that is talked about as part of universal background check proposals and could potentially make that not even an option for some people. Although very few states would fall into that category right now.
Well, one person told me that he stored his gun when he left at a pawn shop, and that was a good,
yeah,
safe place because he didn't have the thought that his home would be would be robbed and he would lose his gun, and the rates were not too terrible. I don't know anything about pawn shops, but maybe
pawn shops come up a lot. You know, for people who want to get rid of their gun permanently, there are police departments who will not take them. And so often the only option for them is to sell it, even if they're not interested in kind of, you know, making any money, or to give it to a pawn shop, which is definitely similarly to the storage problem, probably not ideal if someone is kind of motivated. If you kind of, as a healthcare provider or someone has motivated you to consider the gun in the home as risky and you want to get rid of it, you know, we have to be able to provide people with practical solutions kind of when they're thinking about it. And I think it's something we're really working on. Pawn shops do seem to be the go-to, unfortunately, and certainly doesn't take guns out of circulation, which, you know, is definitely a challenge. And there are police departments who are not permitted by law to destroy weapons. That's definitely an area we're looking at. But sure, that's definitely an option for people, pawn shops, if they're willing to sell it or can convince them to pay something reasonable. And there are some gun clubs who will, if you're a member, for example, you know, have some storage, but it seems to be pretty limited from what we've been able to find out.
Thank you.
Hi.
Before we move on to our discussion with our group, does anybody else have any questions? And then we'll let Jenny and Rebecca go.
I have a quick question, or actually three quick questions. Sorry, this is Kristen from Ohio State. The impulse data that you gave, is that for suicides in general? And how is that obtained?
So it was a study that was done of suicide attempt survivors. And this was one this was the data from one study that was collected, but there have been a couple of different studies that have looked at the same kind of issue in contemplation, and it's basically collected in with interviews of people who have survived serious suicide attempts.
Okay, great. And then was the PCP appointment or seeing PCP, was that along, I'm assuming also from survivors as well?
I believe that was obtained through the psychological autopsy process. I think that was information that was obtained after the fact from, you know, as best they could piece together from interviews and, you know, investigations into people.
Oh, okay. That's even more interesting.
I can double check
my
that.
That would be great.
That's the case.
And then my last question is there any data for individuals who do use a gun for their suicide if they've had any previous attempts or their first-time attempt with a gun?
I'm sorry, you're asking about
in an individual who uses a gun as their mode, have they had previous attempts, or are those individuals who use a gun for their suicide or their attempted suicide, is that their first attempt, or did they attempt some other method before using the gun? Kind of going along the impulse.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I believe there is information on this. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I believe what the research has shown is that most people who attempt with a firearm, it's, you know, their first attempt.
But I will
double check on that and can follow up with you on that as well.
Okay. I really enjoyed your presentation. I'm a neurosurgery resident at Ohio State, and unfortunately, prevention was why I basically joined this committee, because I can't really do much after someone shoots themselves in the head or spine. So this is great. Thanks so much for presenting this.
Thank you to both our speakers and the Brady. So we should transition to our group discussion at some point. Are there any other burning questions before we do that?
Yeah, I have a question. Hello, am I muted or unmuted?
No, you're not muted.
Okay, here's the question. A few years ago, I asked a scholar who studied gun deaths, and especially suicides, how many suicides were murder suicides, and also how many murders were suicides, murder suicides. And it turned out at that time, at least, that those data were not collected. They didn't exist. The CDC did not follow this. Nobody did. Do you know if that remains the case? And if it does, do you know why? Is this has this been prohibited? It seems such an obvious statistic to want to collect.
Right. So the CD, it's a little bit better than probably was when we had that conversation. There's really no context when the CDC reports through Whiskers, which, you know, I'm sure you guys use for other things, that it's not just guns. There's not a lot of context. You know, it's pulled from things like death certificates and, you know, other public information, and it's not really coordinated information. So you just get very, very basic stuff around firearms and the issue you raised in terms of the limitations on the CDC to kind of do additional research on firearms has been around for a while. And even though Obama lifted the, quote-unquote, chokehold or ban through an executive action, there's no funding for CDC to do research. We do have the National Violence Death Reporting System, which is a newer piece, which probably wasn't around when you had that conversation. I think it's, the past 5 years maybe, And that's only in a few states. It's up to, I think, 17 or 18 states. And that provides context, things we never knew, like the relationship between the person who shot and the person who was shot, whether it was domestic, you know, whether there was a gang-related, where it took place. So now from this, we know how many gun deaths happened in the home, which are the majority. So that does have something on murder-suicide, but it's not nationally representative, and it's not something that really is kind of easy to use, frankly, and you have to get some permission to access certain elements of it. But I believe the number that I recall seeing was pretty low in terms of murder-suicide. But certainly these high-profile shootings that we see, which are not representative of typical gun deaths, seem to, should certainly cause us to think about the connection, since many of these public shooters commit suicide. Or, take their own lives with a gun after they've committed the homicide. So I think we can send the NVDRS information, but it is pretty limited, and you have to use it with caution. And I'm not quite sure anything else other than kind of specific types of gun deaths, like school shootings and things like that have some studies behind it. Rebecca, am I leaving anything off on that?
As far as I know, it's not something that we've looked too closely into because it is very different from, an individual taking their own life. So we didn't research that too much in connection with the report. So I can't think of any specific studies off the top of my head.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much, everybody, and thank you, Rebecca and Jenny, for taking some time to chat with us this evening.
Thank you.
Toby, Toby, are you on?
Yes, are we ready to move on? Thank you all very much for taking your time.
Thank you.
Have a great night. So we're gonna finish up getting some updates on some actions that some of our past members have taken, and then finish up talking a little bit about, the talk we just had and maybe some next steps for the Suicide Prevention Month. Mark is going to talk to us. He was able to have contact with both his New York senators, and so he's going to give us an update on that and maybe some next steps there, and then maybe kind of lead us into the next discussion with some thoughts that you might have on some action, and we'll go from there. Mark, are you ready?
Hi, yeah, this is Mark Manso. I'm a psychiatrist in New York City. And actually wrote a piece on means restriction for Gun Violence Prevention Month. It was published on the MPA blog on June 29th. So this is something that it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. But anyway, so I specifically went to visit Gillibrand's office in New York City to talk with a staffer about trying to figure out how we might be able to advocate for increased funding for research, or actually a lift on the ban on funding on more research, because I think we all agree that we need good research and good evidence in order to make policies that are likely to be effective to improve public health. And so I met with a staffer who was actually quite passionate about the issue of violence prevention. He grew up in East New York, which East New York, Brownsville, Central East Brooklyn has the highest rate of gun violence in New York City, actually. It's higher than the South Bronx. So he actually grew up there, and he lost some friends to gun violence. And so we immediately formed a connection. And he put me in touch with some of the D.C. staff that's interested in this issue. But what I sort of took away from it is that it's going to be quite difficult for Democrats at this point to pass with their current numbers and the current pressures that are on them. It's going to be difficult for them to really bring up anything, even the most reasonable sounding issue around gun violence prevention, unfortunately. With the exception of mental health, but I I think it's sort of, even though we need improvements in our mental health care system, that's sort of a scapegoat and a distraction from the gun violence prevention issue. But he was hopeful that the Republicans are defending many, many more Senate seats in 2016 than the Democrats are, and so there might be a change of power. It's possible. And then there would be plenty of opportunities to get things done. And I also just recently heard back from, I've reached out to Senator Schumer's staff, and they are interested in setting up a phone conversation with the judiciary staff in D.C. to try to talk about that issue with them. So I think that I encourage anyone who is interested to contact their own senators and try to set up meetings, phone meetings, in-person meetings, because it was a good experience and it taught me a lot and it informed our mission. And in addition, it could give us some ideas for the advocacy day on October 19th. Some of these conversations could be followed up by other NPA members or by yourself in D.C. So that's pretty much where we are with that. And I was just thinking, I think that lethal means restriction, exactly what the Brady campaign seems to have written a report about and was presenting about today, is probably where it's at with suicide prevention, because unfortunately we don't have much evidence that mental health treatment actually prevents suicide. We think it probably does, but it's really hard to do research on preventing rare events, and suicide is a rare event. And so there's three interventions in psychiatry that have been scientifically proven to prevent suicide: lithium, clozapine, and electroconvulsive therapy. There's no other evidence that we have that the treatment itself prevents suicide. And so I think public health approach to decrease suicide rates is important, and lethal means restriction is key. And like the Brady campaign pointed out, guns are the most lethal means and the most common way that people commit suicide. And actually, they said that 77% of people have visited the primary care physician in the past year who committed suicide. Well, the statistic, actually, there's another statistic, 46% of people visited their primary care physician in the last month. So it's really a primary care issue in addition to a public health issue. And things like lethal means counseling, safety planning, I mean, even asking about suicidal ideation are all things that we could, if we wanted to, focus on during this month of September. And one thing that immediately comes to mind for me is, well, two things. One, does the Brady campaign have materials as part of this report that they could disseminate or ask us to disseminate to physicians to do some of this lethal means counseling in a very practical and quick way? And I didn't get a chance to ask that, actually, because we were sort of running out of time. And then two, would the Brady campaign be willing to give a similar presentation that they gave to us to all of MPA this month as sort of a webinar? That's pretty much all I have to say for right now.
I can answer both of those questions. Yes, they are going to have a variety of resources that are going to be shareable online, as well as in the Twitter world and various other resources when the report's released later this week. And we will post those links for that. We'll circulate it to the task force listserv, as well as posting them in our private section page of the MPA website. And this might be a good time for me to explain the email message. I just switched our screen here. You get into the private page here from the Gun Violence Prevention tab under the Projects section of the MPA website. And then when you click on the tab, it opens up the private section. So then get your pencils. The new password for the private section, all lowercase, GVP-2016. GBP-TF-2015. So that's GBP Task Force 2015. Write that down someplace so you can remember it. We're trying to be more compliant with the cybersecurity side of things. And if you have any, if you lose it, just send me a text or call me and I'll get it to you. But that's the new password, GBP-TF-2015. So we will post the recording of this presentation tonight. We'll go here with our other recorded calls, and we'll post the other resources that they have here in this section, as well as circulate them on the listserv for you. And we can follow up with them about opportunities to do this presentation to the broader membership and look at possible dates. So we'll circle
That's
around
great.
You all on that.
Great. Thanks, Mark. This is Toby again. So we only have a few minutes here. I don't know if anybody else has kind of some thoughts of what some next steps would be. I think hearing from Mark, it sounds like one really good action would be really be just sort of educating our colleagues, since, as you said, the amount of visits that come the month before a suicide attempt. So I think that's, one way, whether that be through engaging your own societies or blogs or going out at that avenue. So does anybody have any kind of thoughts from there, or ways that they are kind of thinking they might be able to reach out and get out that message? Don't all speak at once.
But Toby, this is Sarah. One of the things that I was thinking about doing is just adding it to our practice's weekly blast. Like, my practice has an email list, and so it's very easy for me to put in a little blurb about, keep in mind it's Suicide Awareness Week, asking about just like a couple of the facts that we've been putting to get it in people's mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah. I know at our AFP we have, I guess maybe it's just through Facebook, or maybe it's been, I get it through Facebook, a blog for new positions and I guess AFP leaders that I'm wondering, being Suicide Prevention Month, I can approach them and see if we can do a blog through that. So it's just one way through my academy.
I think reaching out to primary care specialties will be the most effective thing we could do, because even though psychiatrists are experts, most people who commit suicide aren't seeing a psychiatrist.
I have one other kind of wild thought, and this is Jerry again. So we're stymied on the Democrat-Republican front in my state and many others, and I'm just wondering, with all the data we collect these days, has anybody ever tried to find Republicans who have had a death in their family from homicide or suicide that might cross over?
This is Becky. There's some occasional information that we get about that kind of thing that I can make some inquiries about. But really, this is an issue that for way too long has been framed in a partisan way. And the kind of data and the voice that you all can bring to that discussion as physicians and helping to move this out of the Second Amendment frame and into a public health frame is a very powerful voice, and one that, regardless of their party affiliation, they should know about. And so I would strongly encourage you to, think about the Republicans as well as the Democrats and whatever other party folk you have around, and set visits. Go in and talk to them, whether it's at the statehouse level or at your local government. There's some things that happen at a local government level, or with your Congress members, as Mark did here recently. I scrolled down on our website here, and we have fact sheets around the gun violence prevention a research need as well as basic facts, you know, on gun violence. We'll get Sarah, the presentation that the Brady Gals did earlier tonight posted on here for you. We also have, don't forget about the white paper that we did with the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. That's an excellent resource that you can use to share with your elected officials. We have more of them. If you need more copies, just let me know. And there's also a promotional flyer that you can use there. And then I also wanted to quickly point out on our public-facing page here are the recordings of the webinars that we've been doing here, the public-facing ones that we did in the began in the spring. So all of these are recorded, and we had the presentation back in March that also looked at suicide and the California's answer of the gun violence restraining order legislation that they passed and will begin implementing in January. And there are several other states, including Virginia, with the most recent horrible shooting of the journalists there, that are going to be looking at that legislation also. So those are a few things that might help you with it. And you, I'm always happy to, you know, set a time to talk with any of you and help think through opportunities that might be out there.
This is Mark again. I will say if anyone's considering doing this, two pointers. One is do that call with Becky in advance. I did. It was extremely helpful. I got a lot of great ideas and perspective, and then she sent me resources, which I used in the office. And two, I would recommend picking a specific issue. Like I chose to focus on research funding, but you could focus on something else. Rather than talking about gun violence prevention in general, which probably could quickly plummet into the sort of partisan discussion, I think if you pick a specific issue and try to stick to that, it's probably going to be more effective.
Yes, that's great advice, Mark. So it looks like we're kind of closing up here. Does anybody have any last things that they want to add? We'll kind of send out an email sort of summarizing some of this, and if someone can kind of think about it, you know, even if it's something like Sarah said, you know, if you have a blast that goes out to your organization or somehow you're just making it sort of part of just the messaging part, super messaging. Last thing I want to add is I know Sarah has reached out to, I think, all of you as far as the conference coming up. So hopefully you all are planning on attending, or if you're questioning you should attend, we can encourage you. We do hope to have a meeting with the task force, who's ever there, and kind of meet face-to-face and do a brainstorming then as well for anyone that can make it.
Yeah, I'll be there.
When will that meeting be?
It's October 17th through the 17th and 18th, and then a lobby day is Monday the 19th.
But when is is our meeting going?
So that's where we're kind of looking at some spots for that. I think we can, you know, get, depending on when we get people who are going to go, we can send out lists. If there's a thought of there's a time for a breakfast on Saturday morning or Saturday evening to do maybe a dinner, and I think there, Becky's all right, there's maybe a lunch period or another time that's sort of set up for networking amongst the conference, but that we could pull aside and do with our group. So those are kind of three times that we were thinking, and we were going to get some feedback on that.
The networking breakfast time is actually Sunday morning at the conference, yes. And then we will have, there's some different programming that's specially geared toward the gun violence task force members and others that are interested. We'll have a special hands-on session with KNP Communications that did a webinar for us earlier in the year, but they do a really good in-person show. And we're filling up. So if you've been thinking about wanting to come, go ahead and register as soon as you can, especially if you need a hotel room. We do have a good rate at the hotel around the corner from the conference center, but the rooms and the spots are filling up.
Becky, which day Saturday or Sunday are those events with the going to be?
There is programming on Saturday and on Sunday. The session with KNP and the special session with Nick Unger for the gun violence work are both on Sunday, as well as the work, the session around the medical gag laws that is not exclusively about gun violence, but that will be discussed.
Yeah. Is there anything
else? And on Saturday we have some good programming. The keynote speaker is Lena Nguyen, the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore, and we have a panel also with the some of the folks from White Coats for Black Lives. So there will be other ways that gun violence impact in communities will be talked about outside of the clear gun violence track that we have.
I think if some of you haven't been there, and you know, it's not a huge conference, so it really is ideal for meeting other members of MPA and talking, so it's not such a large conference where you get kind of lost. It's really set up for a lot of networking and engaging colleagues, which I think, you know, we don't always get at our conferences.
Yeah, could I ask you a question about the Sunday events, which sound very good. Unfortunately, on Sunday I'm going to be in Reykjavik, Iceland. Is there is any of that Sunday material amenable to distribution afterwards, or is it all spontaneous?
Well, we're not really set up to be able to record the presentations. We will certainly have, for presenters that have slides, we will have those for sharing later, as well as, you know, materials that people bring to share and all.
Yeah. But those people, the presenters themselves, will be there only on Sunday, right?
Well, some of them are, we've invited them to come for as much as they're able to. So some of them may be there on Saturday also. It's up to them. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we ran just a little bit over. So thanks, y'all, for joining in tonight. And we'll just kind of set up some follow-up notes from this call. And we'll keep in contact through emails.
Okay.
And I guess the next one, Becky, do we have a meeting? We'll have a call before the conference, right? We're at the beginning of October. Yeah, so our next call will be the beginning of October.
Would be October 7th, would be the first Wednesday in October. So that would be our next time together before the conference.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Toby.
Bye.
Thank you.